as we promised to do in the spring.
But these are dead. Yeah, right. I can't.
Well, it's about down to the wire for Fairbanks gardeners. Others in other parts of the world may be putting in their third planting about now, but those of us who are tied to the Arctic are just about ready to yank it all up, and we'll leave summer to frosty dreams for the next few months. If you're a gardener, or you'd like to be one, or if you'd like to listen, you know, just listen to a conversation about growing things for the next hours, stay with us. Give us a call between now and 1 and join in on the discussion. I'm Susan McGinnis, host of KUAC-FM's Conversations. With me today in this show I've called A Gardener's Journal, Patty Kostelic, Walt Benisch, and John Leipzig, all gardeners who love the craft and the play associated with the green thumb. You know, just before we came to air, we were moaning. My garden has such potential. All I need is about 30 more days.
You got it.
That's right. The sweet peas are beginning to bloom. I've got a couple of vases of them in the house. The tomatoes are beautiful, big, green. Oh, green is a shirt in your back. Mm-hmm. I gather this is not just a problem of a small downtown plot belonging to Susan McGinnis. John Leipzig, you're shaking your head.
No, up on the hills, the same thing. I've got lovely green tomatoes. I went so far as to put cloches of plastic over them. Now I've got a few red ones. And my wife and I, for the first time, reestablished the 8x10 lean-to greenhouse that we have that we use only for starting things. We decided to finish things this year with it so that we now have that running with a heater at night and so on. So I'll have tomatoes in about 30 days.
30 days. Patty?
Amazing to me. My garden was not only incredibly late, but sort of past its prime and late at the same time. It never quite got there, and then it was past the bloom. It's a disappointing year with a wonderful start. I was so excited in early June at how hot it was and how things were growing, but it was a short heat spell, hot spell, and July was a fizzle.
Fizzle. Well, Benisch, how does your garden grow at this time?
The same story. Except that I would add that the cloudburst and hailstorm that we had early on in the summer washed out a lot of the lettuce and carrot seeds, which are now coming up between the rows. In the rows, nothing is growing in certain places. Uh-huh. But it's been a very bad summer, a strange summer.
Well, and tell me why. John Leipzig, just before we came to air, you were saying you thought it was Mount Pinatubo.
Well, it could be. I mean, we're talking about global warming. We're talking about global cooling now. That indeed, the effect of a volcano is a multitude of degrees, actually. We've seen some pretty spectacular sunsets when we've seen the sun at all. Mm-hmm. They say it probably won't affect us much this winter because we don't have that much sun. But I'm wondering if it did affect us somewhat this summer. Walt was saying something about cycles of 4 years anyway. So,
what's your theory on cycles of 4 years, Walt Benisch?
I don't have a theory. It's just that it seems to be that we get a very wet late summer about every 4 or 5 years. And that certainly takes care of the squash because they don't set their blossoms and fruit, the female blossoms, until a little later on when the days get shorter. And if as the days get shorter, it's cooled down, then they're not going to set fruit or will set it very slowly. And so I know we have a lot of winter squash in the garden, but they're about the size of golf balls. If we get two out of an entire row, it will be a lot.
My zucchini are great, 10, 11 pounds, gorgeous, but my pumpkins stop at about, well, somewhere between a golf ball and a tennis ball.
Even the zucchini, and I noticed at the fair, it's very tough-skinned, very tough-skinned, not that tender, fast-growing stuff that you get when July is warmer.
Okay, it was a wretched summer.
Well, this is just heartbreaking for those of us who start looking at seed catalogs in February and start some kind of planning in March or April and have some kind of misguided belief that because there was a very hard winter in terms of a lot of snow and a lot of dealing with the climate, that we were somehow deserving of a wonderful summer. And when you don't even get winter squash and when things are much less satisfactory than in an ordinary year, I have no idea what that means for this winter. I simply don't know.
And one of the other problems, a wonderful year for like grass and herbs and things like that, but you have nothing to put them on, the herbs.
Right, great dill, no cucumbers.
I have cucumbers. You can't have them. If you had a terrible year and you'd like to come call in and cry with us, because we're going to cry for a few more moments here, you can dial 474-5044 and join in on this conversation. If, on the other hand, you manage to outwit the summer and you have gorgeous tomatoes of one sort or another, or fruit of one sort or another, give us a call, 474-5044. I'm Susan McInnes, and this is Conversations.
It did help me confirm my beliefs about the moose in our neighborhood, and I have talked to a lot of people who have had moose this year. It seems, I know we have children's books about moose eating the garden and so on, so it's not an unusual occurrence. But this year, because my broccoli and cauliflower and cabbage were all so much later, normally I have them mid to third week in July at perfection, and this year it was 10th, 15th of August, and there were the moose about a day or so before we had planned to harvest, and luckily they showed up in our garden at 2 in the afternoon, and my husband Sam was looking out of the window from his computer and saw them out there, and so managed to chase them away, not easily, but did get some of the crop. But that proves to me that they wait till the vegetables are at perfection. They don't just wander in willy-nilly in the middle of July. It's a planned activity for them.
Do you
harvesting
think
the gardens.
There's a hotline they call each other?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
So there is a brighter side to the whole thing, though, and that which goes along with the heat and then the cold. We have a lot of flowers. We have terraced flower gardens that my wife has. And we have never had so many flowers as this year. And most of the things like the candy tuft are self-seeding. They're not plants that we set out. And because it was so hot and then it's been damp, they have done just very, very well. And so if you're a flower gardener, with the exception of roses and things which mildew easily, this may have been an exceptional summer, which it certainly was for us. It has never been so beautiful as far as the color is concerned.
And that's true, downtown as well as in people's private gardens. My daisies have just taken off. Usually I'm out praying to the God of Daisy, saying, come on, bloom for me. But now they're all on their own, very satisfactory. 474-5044, if you want to join us. I'll give the number periodically as we're talking. Well, Benes, you have a smaller pest in your gardens. Patty frets about moose, but you have another fellow who...
Yeah, we fenced the moose out several years ago when we started raising apple trees, and also fenced out the neighbor's dogs, incidentally, which is another advantage. But that doesn't catch the mice. And I think probably anybody in the area who had ornamental shrubs or apple trees last winter realized when the snow went away that the damage was just extensive. I know our lawns, and I've talked to a number of other people, our lawn looked like somebody had gone over it with a cat because the grass was just dug up and piled in tunnels the way the voles do that. But the real tragedy was the mice were able, because of the depth of the snow, to get up into the branches on trees and shrubs. And I've had to prune back two of the apples that I have extensively, because not because they killed the trees, but because they killed so much of the branch work up high. Smaller trees, smaller shrubs, they will girdle. And when it's a year with a lot of snow or a warm winter, and last winter was both, they thrive and multiply under the snow. So
and they go up and eat the bark?
And they will climb up, they'll tunnel up in the snow. It enables them to climb high. So even I wrap many of my trees in the fall up about a foot and a half to 2 feet, which is where the branches begin here with the apples. They're essentially bushes, they're not trees. But if the snow is 3 feet or 4 feet high, then the mice can get up into the branches of the trees, and they love sweet barks. About the only shrub that I'm aware of that they don't eat is the chokecherry, which is apparently either very bitter or slightly toxic, and so they stay away from the chokecherries. But if you wanted some suggestions, which is what you and I were talking about the other day, I started already in my trees, which are both in the garden and on the lawn, I started going out and very carefully clearing all of the grass away from the bottom of the trees, because the grass pulls the mice in the winter. That's where they start. And then they move over to the bark, which is quite edible. So I would clear all the grass away from the bottom of the trees, then either wrap the tree trunk, if it is a tree, or if it is a bush, and you have enough hardware cloth, which is quarter inch to half inch at the most size, you could put that around the entire structure. The other alternative, the one that I use, is that after the first snow is on the ground and the birds are gone, you have to be very careful with the birds here, I then set out little boxes of poison for the mice. What I do is cut up a piece of plywood and make a bunch of 8x8 or 10x10 boxes with a 1 inch to inch and a half hole into it, and then set a little dish of wafarin in there, which is not as toxic as some of the other poisons that are available. You can get in the hardware store for mice. But put that in there in a little dish, put a lid on it, and then set it near my trees. And the mice will go for the wafarin and the poison first, and that brings me through the winter usually. Last winter, I got the boxes out too late, and the snow was too deep, and I couldn't catch the mice. But that's another alternative. It has to be done in boxes, though, because the birds will also eat it, and it will poison the birds. The problem with, because you could set mice traps too, but the problem with them is that they're not very effective, and you do catch birds in them. So I would warn away from mouse traps.
Are there other ways that you put your trees down for the winter?
Apart from wrapping and preparing for the mice, getting the grass away from them, no. I would mention something else that I'm sure John is aware of. Anybody who has apple trees in the area or shrubs that have large leaves that have a tendency to break is that after the first frost, or, well, let's say by the 1st of October, most of the trees that are imported do not lose their leaves like our local trees. Our local trees know by the 1st of July that it is over with, and they stop growing. But choke cherries, the European bird cherries, the apples, some of the other larger trees do not lose their leaves. The leaves will freeze and stay on the trees, and that doesn't make any difference if it's a year of light snow. But like last year when the snow was heavy, you actually have to go out after the first snow or two, and you can see what's going to happen, and strip the leaves by hand. Because if you don't, you'll lose your branches. And the branch doesn't actually have to break to be destroyed. It can simply put enough weight on it that it stretches and cracks, and you may not even notice it and still lose the branch.
Tell me why you're going to lose the branch if the leaf stays on the branch.
Because the snow accumulates on the leaves. It provides an ideal weight situation. And I have even one Siberian crab that I didn't, which is, you know, Siberians are completely hardy here in the interior. They're very strong, but I lost most of one because I didn't get to it before the tension cracked the branches. Nothing broke, but it cracked it.
In fact, the same thing holds true, for example, if you've got some of the domesticated raspberries like the Kiskas, which tend to hold on the leaves. So what will happen, it will spread all the new floricane down and drop it right down and really crack it at the base, and so you lose most of your raspberry production. Another thing I do with trees, and again, you know, we get a lot of, like Grant said last time we were together, it rains a lot, but we don't get a lot of moisture. So a lot of times I found some real good success with using a root feeder and feeding water right down to the root zone just before the freeze up, so that it's not dry when it starts to get active in the spring. Mm-hmm. That's the only other thing. Of course, you got to play around with water temperature. But
no pruning in the fall?
I don't do a lot of pruning in the fall. I prune basically year-round, but not a lot just in the fall.
We were talking about pruning the other day, Walt, and you said there are some bushes and trees which can take it and others which it's not good.
I personally avoid pruning in the fall if possible, because there's no chance for the wound to heal. And if one does prune, then to get an asphalt emulsion on it immediately, which is, you know, is produced for tree wounds. But I would do this, and I've been doing it myself. I've gone around and looked at my trees, particularly the Siberian crab apples, these decorative apples, some of the choke cherries, to see where growth has been very extensive in one direction, and then I have a prime candidate for snowbreak. Mm-hmm. And I have cut a couple of those off and treated them, because later on that will break.
So much of putting a garden together and putting it to bed is looking ahead. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes, your regular weekday host, weekend host for this program. Walt Benesch is with us. He's a professor of philosophy here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. In fact, we are an all-university crew. John Leipzig is an associate professor of speech communications, and Patty Kostelic is the director of advisory services here at the university. And we're talking about none of that today. Today we want to talk to you about your garden, the place at which you find it now and the place at which you may find it in a month or two, what you can do to help bridge that river. We have a caller on the line. I'd like to remind others, if you want to get involved in this conversation, the number to call is 474-5044. You've been patient. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, my question is about bulbs. And I live in downtown Fairbanks, and I would like to plant some daffodil bulbs and tulips and maybe crocuses. I'm wondering what time of year should I do that?
Can any of my people in studio hear these people? Oh, isn't this sad? Hold on, we'll work on something. You were talking about, I pushed the right button.
Okay.
You want to plant bulbs for
yeah.
crocus and what else?
Crocuses and daffodil and tulip bulbs.
When and how?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I know how to do it. I think you have to plant them deep and far apart. But I wondered what time of year. I mean, I know it's in the fall, but I didn't know when.
We have much gesticulation going on in the studio here. When you were saying plant deep and far apart, John Leipzig was shaking his head, so let's start with that part.
Okay. In another state.
In another state.
Yeah,
in
not
Florida.
Deep.
Yeah, I just moved from northern Minnesota, and so that's why I'm calling.
One of the problems with deep is that about between 12 and 18 inches, you run into a phenomenon which is almost always frozen ground. That's why our spruce trees don't have really tap roots but tend to go out very long horizontally, that they don't really like it down there deep. So basically, you have to maybe at least have the distance that you're used to and get it up in that area. Probably the other problem with some of the bulbs is that if it's the standard Holland kind of bulb, you might get 1 year out of it. Don't expect it to come back again because it just won't store enough energy in the summer. Some folks put them in and take them out and try to save them in the garage, and if they don't wither up, you're probably okay. However, there are a series of things like little hardy tulips and hardy areas that do really well, and again, you plant them but not too deeply, and they'll come up, but they aren't the real magnificent double floral kind of things. Like the daffodils I have, the narcissus I have, are probably the size of a quarter would be pushing it.
And I have heard of people who put them in the refrigerator or some cool basement that will cause a dormant period. And then when you can work the soil in the spring, they plant them. And then, of course, the time is off. It's you don't get the flowers in early spring as you're used to in other places, but you do have tulips in June or daffodils in June.
We have one additional statement. And here's a thought if you're just arriving. Seek out a book called The Beginner's Guide to Successful Gardening in the Fairbanks Area. Long title, but the message is fairly direct. Eloise DeWitt wrote it. She's a master gardener, has been such in Fairbanks for roughly 40 years, 50 years. Now here's what she says about tubers, bulbs, and shrubs. This is an oral reading here. Now is the time to dig the begonia tubers and any bulbs you wish to save. Let them dry for a day or two, then pack them into boxes in single layers, stem side up, filled with dry peat moss, Jiffy Mix, or Ready Earth, the latter two being commercial names, so that they can rest for the winter. Store them in as cold a place as you can without freezing. That's about 40 degrees, she says. And at cleanup time, Eloise finds it helpful to trim the shrubs, cut the seed pods from the lilac trees, and do anything else that will save me time in the spring, a subject I want to ask about a little later. I don't know whether that's helpful. Is that helpful?
I guess so, yeah. So I can plant them now. This would not be too early.
Well, you can pluck them now. Planting them now would make them very cold in the winter.
I see.
Right.
So it's a spring deal to plant them in the spring.
Yeah.
Well, one of the other questions would be where you're planting them. And around here, a house basement will throw off quite a bit of warmth through the winter, and you'll tend to get better results if you're near a house than if you're putting them out in a garden away from the house. And so if you're putting them near the house, you might be able to plant them now. If they're out in the garden, I don't know.
And there are hundreds of microclimates. If you're up on a ridge, if you're downtown, you can plant some things that I can't. I live between the airport and the river, and it's a real cold spot. And although I don't live on permafrost, I think it's just the next thing to it. And so I have not been successful at any peonies, for example, except a Japanese peony, which isn't like those big Midwestern beautiful things. And there are some people downtown who have gorgeous peonies, that as an example of a perennial. That,
and we have them, but we're higher up on the ridge.
But you're up on the ridge. And so a little bit of difference, and I guess the only thing you can do is look at what your neighbors have and do a little experimenting.
This is Conversations. If you have advice or a question, give us a call. Thank you for your call, caller. We have another caller on the line. You're listening to Conversations, and you're on the air.
Hi. You kind of caught my attention there when you were talking about saving your fruit trees for the winter. Last year, I religiously wrapped with some kind of a holy white material my cherry trees, sweet cherry trees. Bushes. One of them's a Nanking variety, and the other one I can't recall. But the mice got into those things, and I had about 10 of them, and they stripped the bark off every one but two, and I thought for sure I'd lost them. And I just decided to wait a little bit and see what happened, and I'll be darned if they didn't just grow back and flourish this summer. But I don't want to repeat that again this winter. And I heard you talking about a hardware wrap, and I wonder if you could tell me a little bit more about that. And also, these are sort of bushy, and I'm wondering how you wrap the bushy part real well.
Well, Benish.
Well, the hardware cloth, the term cloth is a misnomer in there, because it's essentially hardware fence. It's a very small galvanized square fence. That is, the holes in the fence are square, about a quarter of an inch, which would be as large as I would go to a half an inch. You can buy it in rolls. It's very expensive. And what you would do is essentially, as with chicken wire, build a fence around the bush and posts and just encircle it with that hardware cloth. My suggestion would be that it's going to be a lot simpler to get to build two or three little boxes and put some wafer in, which is, you know, you can get in Pay and Save or any other hardware store in town. Put that in little dishes and set it out after about the 1st of October. And the mice will go for that usually before they go for your bush. And they'll take it back to their nests, and it will kill poison over a period of time more mice than you would believe. And it is not a violent poison. That's one of its effective uses, is that the rat or the mouse that's eating, it's what the burrow uses, for example, at the dump, or most commercial enterprises that have feed around use it, because it doesn't make the animal sick and it's not painful, and so the animal keeps eating it. That's my understanding. But I think that would be an easier way to deal with the mice than the very expensive project of the hardware cloth. But the hardware cloth, if it's right down on the ground, you'll want to bury the bottom of the fence so that it freezes in the dirt. And if you put that all the way around your tree, that will keep the mice out. Make sure that the snow never gets over the top of it, because if the snow gets over the top of it, they'll go over the top of it on the snow.
And into the tree.
And into the tree.
Yeah, that's kind of the tough part. We don't know how deep our snow is going to be this year.
Well, you keep shoveling it off.
Yeah. Well, I was told to, when I put these in last year, I was told to cover the plants up for the winter to protect them.
The Nanking cherry, I wouldn't worry about. I've had them for years, and nothing seems to bother them except the mice.
Uh-huh. And I've got a couple apple varieties, and they got into one, but they didn't get the other one. But I'm going to go ahead and take your advice, and that's wafern, W-A-F-A-R-I-N?
W-A-F-E-R-I-N, I think
wafern.
It is.
Wafern, okay. I'll remember that.
One of the... Can we give commercial name? Okay. Decon. If you go into any of the hardware stores, it comes in little packages, Decon. Some of it is green pellets, which I prefer because I think it has a better flavor. And the other is seed that's been treated with wafern. I would stay absolutely away from strychnine, which you can get still in mouse poison, because that kills not only the mouse, but everything that eats the mouse and everything that even thinks about eating that which ate the mouse.
Right, that wouldn't be any good.
That's terrible stuff. But
yeah,
the wafern is fine. It's a very limited poison, breaks down quickly, and is easily available.
Won't hurt the cats and dogs. And
No, they're not going to go near it.
And the boxes, of course, are just little squares with little mouth holes in them.
That's what the reason for the square, I'd say you can make a figure an 8-inch square or a 10-inch square box with a lid on it with two little holes, one for the mouse to go in and one for the mouse to go out. The reason for that is that the birds will also eat the poison if it's lying around open. And you'll kill a lot of your birds. And so I would go with the boxes and just the mice. The other nice thing is the shrews won't eat it, who are eating the mice. And you want the shrews around. You don't want the mice, but you want the shrews.
Okay.
Okay.
And one other question.
Okay, one more.
I have a couple trees I'd like to remove, and I was wondering, is there something you can put in the ground to kill them?
An axe.
I'd like to use them for firewood. I kind of want to leave them up and let them dry standing up. Is there, if I put salt in the ground?
What kind of trees are they?
One birch and one cottonwood.
The cottonwood, that when you kill it, it's going to come up everywhere.
Okay.
The problem with, there are poisons, that herbicides that you can poison the tree with, but you want to remember that that moves out the entire root system. And so you've put that poison everywhere where those roots go. The thing you could do if you want the tree to stand and dry out and die would be to simply go around with an axe, or in, as in our case, let your son go around with the axe at about 4 years of age and girdle the tree.
Right, yeah.
And it will die.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I enjoy your program.
Well, thanks very much. I'm glad you listened, and I'm glad you called. You're listening to Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. With me, Walt Benesch, Patty Kostelic, John Leipzig, gardeners all. The phone number to call if you would like to join us with your thoughts or questions or advice, 474-5044. We'll be here till about 1 o'clock. Patty, you mentioned to me the other day on the phone that you do yourself no favor by waiting too long to put your garden to bed. Translate.
Just my experience now, maybe partly because I'm involved with the university and very involved with registration and so on, but there's a time when I want to enjoy every last bloom, although they're sort of few and far between, and then you turn around and the ground's frozen solid. Depends on the year, but that period seems to be fairly short. And I guess we all in this room even have maybe different ways that we deal with our garden in the fall, but it is very important to get all that vegetation, all those weeds that may be there now after all this rain, and get it up so that you can avoid fungus. And we rototill our garden every fall and every spring, and in the fall we chop up vegetation that is from the vegetables and some grass and so on, and till that back in. Where we are, we don't have great drainage. We don't have fabulous sunny ridge exposures, and so I think it helps dry. It breaks up the soil and helps it dry up earlier in the spring than it would. Now, if you're on the side of a hill, maybe that's not necessary. But the work you do with your soil is the most important thing that you do for your garden. So I know a lot of people get discouraged at this time of year, and it freezes, and they just want to walk away from it. But that's a bad idea.
Well, it will not walk away from you, actually. Right. No. Yeah.
True. In fact, the fungus is the real important thing. That you've got a phenomenon here by the name of snow mold. And snow mold's a really nasty thing that'll get you real quick, and it'll get anything you leave green in nitrogen, including your grass. So it's really important, if you want to save your grass, to mow it really nice and tight, get those clippings off, clip off your asparagus tops if you're lucky enough to have asparagus, get all that stuff out of there. Some people even go so far as to, after the first snow that usually melts, to go out and hit the grass with a fungicide like trifluorine or something that... Anyway, the Extension Service, other people have been working on that. But
and what's the mold going to do? What's the fungus going to do to your yard, to your plants, to your grass?
It'll kill everything it touches, basically.
Just
there are a few things.
Up.
You'll notice in the spring, usually as the snow is coming off, this little spider webby type of stuff. And everybody goes, oh, gee, some kind of insect. Oh, no, snow mold. And basically what it's happening is it's dying at that point once it's actually fully exposed. But it'll kill that patch. Now, it'll come back. You can scrape it up, and the roots will come back and recolonize it. But you'll see these big dead spots in grass lawns. That's snow mold.
I have those.
Yeah, that's what they are.
Every year.
Every year.
I think something large has slept on it. Well, it's true. It's a snow mold,
that's
right?
True. It's slept on it.
Large mold.
Right. Yeah, that's why we don't have a lot of grains and so on. They just can't seem to get the winter wheats through the snow mold.
Now, what I do with my garden at the end of the year, and I'm going to turn this towards you, Walt Benesch, to respond to it, is I pull everything up, and then I throw, thank you, very, very good, that was a good first step, and then I throw everything but the tomato plants out on the lawn, and then I mow my lawn, and in process I mow all the plants up because I don't have a shredder. Shreds it up, and I put it all over the vegetable garden and flower garden spaces, go rent a rototiller or borrow one from my dear friend and till it all in. Which, and I'm following Patty's logic, is it helps aerate the soil and dry it out and get it ready for spring, and when I get out there in the spring again, I can just run the tiller, and I've got lots of vegetable matter in my garden. My understanding is you don't do that, Walt Benesch. You do something quite different.
This is where we would disagree, absolutely. I would preface any remarks I make with the fact that we have a large chicken yard, and so everything goes out of the garden into the chicken
into
yard,
the gullet.
And the chickens do that for us, and the turkeys. But one, I wouldn't leave anything on the ground. But we do not till at all in the fall, and in fact, we don't till much at all in the spring. A couple of reasons for that. One, there are earthworms in Alaska, and there are earthworms in Fairbanks, and if you go out in the woods and dig up a tree and look at the root system carefully, you'll find some very small earthworms in there. And one of the ways that the earthworms winter, particularly if it is a cold winter, is that the egg cases winter and the worms themselves may freeze. If it's a warm winter like last year was, the worms themselves will winter. And I know this spring in planting things, we had worms that were 3, 4, 5, 6 inches long, beautiful worms. And through the years, we have found that if you till the garden in the fall, you turn the egg cases in the ground up, you tend to kill whatever earthworms you have. Now, what I don't till in the spring either. The reason for that is, one, the worms are there, but two, by tilling, you tend to dry your soil out. And it gets very hot and dry here, as we discovered this year, for about 2 months, and you don't want to lose that initial soil moisture. So I'm essentially against tilling. I have raised beds in the garden. You keep the kids off of them in the winter because they will stamp them down. They stay nice and fluffy. If you don't till them, they keep the moisture and are ready to go in the spring. But I would get rid of all the plants. Now, there's another thing I'd mention there, and that is that the broccoli, the cabbage, the Brussels sprouts, cauliflower in particular, harbor maggots. And if you leave those root systems in the ground, you will enable the maggots to winter as well. And so where you have cabbage, I wouldn't till the ground, but I would pull out the stalks and make sure that there's nothing in the root system in the ground. But otherwise, I don't till. And I found that actually works better. In fact, we have such a problem sometimes in the spring with the earthworms, and people don't believe this until they see it, that we have the robins move in, and they tend to scratch the seeds out, getting the earthworms. There are so many, but the beds that have been untilled for 2 or 3 years essentially consist of worm casings. It's just a mass of reworked soil. So if I do put in new humus about every 3 years from the chicken yard, and then I till it in, but then leave it completely alone, and if you don't have worms, you can buy them locally, throw them in, they will do your tilling for you. One more thing I would mention in putting the garden to bed is that this is also the time, probably about the 1st of September, to plant your carrots for next year. And they will take a major advantage of the moisture that's already in the soil. You can't till it, or if you do till it even, plant your carrots, because they'll be off to an early start and you'll have the largest carrots ever by the end of the summer.
No kidding.
They don't freeze. It doesn't hurt the seeds. Most lettuces can be planted the same way, but the carrots are particularly important.
Some of the alliums, too. For example, I found my shallots that I'd accidentally left in beautifully this year after wintering over.
Well, there is a Welsh onion here that winters, and actually it multiplies by putting out more and more bulbs. Those winter beautifully, and they're the first things that are green in the spring. So you have green onions by the middle of May.
Do they not attract maggots?
No, they don't seem to pull maggots.
I might have it either. Yeah.
Because other kinds of onions do, and that's why I got discouraged with them.
We have a caller. Are you still waiting?
Yes.
Oh, thank you for your patience. Come ahead.
Yes, I have two questions, really. The first is, could you give me some advice about overwintering fuchsias? What's the best location to put them while they're dormant? And the second question is, do any of you have water gardens, and how do you overwinter those?
John does, right?
I'm starting one, so I'm, I can give you some guesses on the water garden.
Let's start with the fuchsia. Anyone have advice on overwintering your fuchsias?
In the house where it's dark, if possible, and fairly cool, they will lose their leaves and sort of look awful, but they do seem to winter all right. I think you're better off with new fuchsias, though, because it so weakens the plants.
Yeah, I had one I saved for 3 years, and I finally tossed it this year. One of the things I found, I needed to prune it back so as to keep only a small part of the new year's growth from which the next year's growth would come from. Otherwise, it got so straggly. And then I always kept mine downstairs in the garage. 50 degrees is the best I could do. And kept it not wet at all, but not dry either. And then it would always start too early, and I'd have to find some sunny spot to put it in. And so I'm going to start with new ones, like Walt said.
Yeah. My geraniums, I have one that lasted 4 years. It was the old man of the house. It was gorgeous for the first three. The fourth year, it was so sad all winter long. You could hear it weeping in the corner. Mm-hmm. And it refused to do anything for me this year. Mm-hmm. So I think probably there's a limit on how far you can stretch your fuchsia.
Water gardens. One thing that's, if you've got lilies, there's two ways to handle it. One, the tropical lilies, of course, you could treat as annuals here and then just toss them. If you're trying to perennialize the lily, if the water garden freezes, the lily will die. So, you've got to pull those bulbs up, again, store in the refrigerator, or, as we were talking the last time, possibly find a nice lake to bury the pot in or whatever, because, again, those lilies will not make it if the whole water garden freezes. I'm real tempted also to drain the water garden, but then again, it may be better if you let it freeze up the top and then drain it in the spring and start over again. So, again, these are new things that we're starting. So,
what, did you pour concrete? I mean, what holds your water garden?
I've got a rubber liner that I ordered from Gardener's Supply, which I think is a little better than the plastic because it's got a little better life expectancy. The real key in putting it down, of course, I've got real schisty soil, which will have a nice way of trying to work its way through the bottom. Or if you have dogs jump in with claws, it's kind of nasty. But basically, once you've got your whole configuration, you can make it almost any size.
How big is yours?
6x8.
Huh?
6x8. With
good size?
Yeah, it's fairly good size. Just to line it with sand. Just a small, it's only 18 inches deep. But line it with sand, which provides a little cushion then for the rubber or plastic. And then keep the dogs out if you can. Retrievers seem to like it.
And the result is you've got water lilies and other water plants growing
water
in your yard?
And water plants growing in the yard with a little waterfall or bubbler keeping the water aerated.
Nice. How far have you gotten with your water garden? Have you? Are you there, caller?
Yes.
Hi. How far have you gotten with your water garden? Have you started?
Yes. There was one at the house that I bought when I bought it 2 years ago, and so this is my second summer with it. And this winter, I think I'm going to just drain it, and because it took so long. I have a very deep one. Mine was 30 inches deep, and it took so long for the mass of ice to thaw this spring that I couldn't get things out very early. It was probably the last thing that unthawed in the summer. So I'm going to try draining it this year.
So you're going to drain it and bring in all your bulbs, like John says, or?
Yes.
Yeah.
I have a spare bedroom a spare bathroom with a tub, and I'm just sticking everything in the tub with the light.
There's an interesting insight on the frogs or toads. There's some argument among biologists here as to which they are, but they don't winter in the mud in the ponds the way they do elsewhere. They dehydrate in the fall and winter in the forest because because ponds tend to freeze all the way to the bottom. And so they survive by dehydrating and overwintering in brush and in the trees and come down in the spring and to multiply.
And do they hibernate? Do they sleep?
Yeah, right. Their blood gets so thick, it's like antifreeze. And so they sleep in the winter in the forest. And then in the spring, that's why the ponds take off. You can tell that the ice has melted enough around the edges that the frogs can come in, but if you go down to any of those ponds, you'll find the pond itself is still frozen pretty solid.
They and the big mosquitoes. I worked that out.
Caller, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
The number to call is 474-5044 if you'd like to join us on the air with your advice, questions, or new direction for this conversation. I'm Susan McInnes. With me, Patty Kostelic, John Leipzig, and Walt Benisch. We're talking about gardens and putting it to bed. Did we deal with fungus and pests, and we dealt with moose, we dealt with mice.
Could I interrupt on the fungus for just a minute.
No interruption.
I have a suggestion that lots of people, particularly not only winter but spring, are not aware of. We have two, there are two excellent fungicides available, one of them locally in the forest and the other one over the counter in your local Whole Earth store. One of them is chamomile tea, which is a mild fungicide, and if you have problems with damping off in your starters, if you will water the starts in the spring, the seeds, with chamomile tea rather than water, you won't have that problem. The other one is the equisetum or horsetail, which grows here in the woods, and if you set that in water and let it stand for 2 or 3 days, make a real thick brew, don't cook it, just let it stand in the water, you have a second excellent fungicide, and you can pour that on leaves, pour that on starters, and that kills the fungus too.
You use sulfur at all too?
No, sulfur gets to be fairly complicated and also very expensive.
Yes, true.
So the simple home recipe seems to be the best.
Right.
All right, take care of your fungus. We have three callers on the line. We'll take them 1, 2, 3. First caller, you're here. Can you hear me? Hello?
Am I it?
Yeah, you are it.
All right.
Come ahead.
Well, we're on the hill, fairly near the university, up near the muskox. And I wondered if someone was going to talk more about the raspberries. We had the best raspberries this summer that we've ever had.
Mm-hmm, I did too.
They were so big and plump and delicious. The other thing, we just brought in our water garden, and we really don't have a garden. I guess we have a pool and a fountain. And I put a lot of those kind of ferns that return each year. And it seems to be a nice place. I'm going to hang fuchsias and other things from the birch trees. And it's a gathering place for birds, and that's what I use it for.
Lovely.
Kind of a nice notion. Thank you very much for this program. I've learned a lot of things, especially about those apple trees.
Good.
Thank you.
Thanks to Walt. I'm glad you called. We'll talk to you again. Hi, you're on Conversations.
Yes, I've got two questions. One, I'm thinking about transplanting some small spruce, maybe 3 foot tall, and forming a hedge with them. And I'd like some advice as to transplant technique and whether this is a good time of year. And the second question is, I have some lilacs, which I diagnosed as being under-fertilized. They have real light green leaves and so forth. And I'm wondering about sticking some of those fertilizer spikes in the ground or fertilizing them now. Is it advisable to do it now, or should I wait till next spring to take care of that?
Well, Bennis, you're shaking your head.
No, I wouldn't fertilize much of anything now, because if you do, and we get a warm September, things will start to grow, and particularly with the lilacs, you'll lose all your bloom next year. So what I would do is wait till spring, and then I don't think the sticks would give you enough fertilizer. I would go through with either a liquid fertilizer or with some, pellet fertilizer, but fertilize them heavily. Lilacs take a lot of food, but I wouldn't prune them now. As far as the spruce and transplanting are concerned, and there are a lot of arguments over that, I prefer to do that in the spring. That gives them a chance to grow, and if you keep them very wet, there shouldn't be any problems with transplanting at all. The danger now is that depending upon how the winter works, you may lose a lot of it.
Well, now here's a question about that transplanting. Since, as John pointed out, our roots don't tend to be a taproot going straight down into the ground because of the extreme cold the deeper you go, but instead to spread out. When you're standing looking at a spruce tree of X feet tall, how far do you figure you ought to cut around to make your hole and dig him out?
My suggestion would be, first of all, the tree no more than 6 feet at the very most. But my suggestion would be that as much area as you can dig up, not so deep, but around, the more survival you're going to get.
Because you get more of those roots.
You get more of those roots, mm-hmm. Yeah.
In fact, the little feeder roots are out at the end, mm-hmm. at the very end of the tree. So a lot of people, if they're dumping water around the base of the tree, it's not doing as well as getting out into the feeding zone, out where the little hairs are.
And you could damage it by cutting off those feeder roots.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay. We've done a lot of transplanting, and very successfully. And I'd say for a tree that's 3-4 feet tall, and by the way, they grow very quickly once they get a little extra loving care. So I would choose a nicely shaped one that's a bit smaller, and you'd probably be more successful. But the kind of root ball we get is something that sort of overlaps the edges of a wheelbarrow. It's a, just a big pie-shaped thing, and we have never lost one.
Great.
So.
Inquiry to make there. Could you talk a little bit about the successes and the techniques there for asparagus? And I'll hang up and let someone else get on.
Thanks for your call. I'll talk to you later.
Well, let's see. I've tried a couple. I started out with the original Martha Washingtons before the new ones came up, and they tended to kind of clump together and ended up with, if best, pencil-sized little stalks of asparagus. 2 years ago, they came up with the New Jersey hybrids, which are supposedly super males, all males. So I sent off dutifully to one of the places, and I put them in. One of the things that seems to be important with asparagus, again, not too deep, not the classic depth that you have with asparagus in Wisconsin or whatever, maybe about half that. They seem to like horse manure underneath it to begin with. A little layer of soil over that before you set the root down. And then maybe in 3 years, if it's still surviving, it does pretty well. Mine's in the second year now, and I got some pretty good spikes that came up. They were not all male, however, and I got an apology from the folks that said, oops, we goofed. I noticed all these little flowers on them. But closer to the house, if you can do that, not too deep. And that's about it for asparagus. And they tend to clump. They won't spread all over. They'll stay in clumps.
Great.
And if you're successful, consider yourself very, very lucky.
As in corn in 1991.
Yes.
This is Conversations. We're putting our gardens to bed, and in process of talking about that subject, we're talking all over the year as well. When to prune, how to watch for fungus, how to deal with it, large pests and small, what to do with your specialties, your water gardens, your asparagus, or if you deal with basic specialty, just whatever you've got out there. We have a caller on the line. If you'd like to get in on this conversation, the number to call is 474-5044. I'm Susan McGinnis. Hi, you're on Conversations.
Hi, I would like to know how to get chickweed out of flower garden beds.
Pull it.
Okay, when you put the bed to rest this fall, I guess what I'm trying to ask is how can you make it so that it won't come back in the spring?
Could
Walt Benish.
Yeah, could I offer a suggestion? I think you're stuck with pulling it because
okay.
I'm not a great believer in poisoning the soil because you do kill all sorts of other things, including the worms. But this is another argument for not tilling. Once you have cleaned a bed of the weeds, and if you turn it over, then you've brought up all the weed seed that's down in the earth. And you get a fresh start on all of them. Once a bed is clean of weed seed, then you've taken care of the problem. So if you'll spend one season keeping track of your chickweed, I'd go out there now and get rid of all the weed. I wouldn't till it. I'd just pull it up so that no new seed goes into the soil, and the next spring keep after it. You'll be rid of your chickweed in about a year. The other thing is to get some geese and fence them into that area, and they love the chickweed, and they'll clean it up. But apart from that, I would not till the soil. That brings all the weeds up again.
You have to worry about seeds falling on the ground throughout the summer?
Yeah, that's why you need to keep after them. Just as frequently as you can remove the weed, you've got to remove it.
The trick with chickweed is twofold. One is never give up. And the other is don't pull it by its hairs. If you pull it by the top of its head, it'll happily break off for you and leave all its roots in the ground and grow more. So reach down and get your fingers in the soil and grab the bottom of the root. I'm in a dilemma, you know, Walt Benish. It took me probably 5 or 6 years of gardening to discipline myself to yearly tilling. And here you're giving an elegant argument for stopping this.
Well, I think his beds have got to be very, very loamy from years of adding manure from his chickens and so on. And so he has got a lot of loft in his soil. And it just depends. I mean, our soil is much, much better than it was when I first got there. But it's not the kind of soil you can put your hands in and just fluff it up. So I think that it's one of those things. I mean, certainly I'm not arguing with the master here. Would we all have soil as good as his? But I've spent many hundreds of hours in my garden on my hands and knees, and I have never seen a worm. not once. Now, I don't know. I mean, it's possible I could buy them and that they would like to live in that cold, wet soil, but I don't know. They're probably happier at Walt's.
Well, in fact, I think Walt brought them in. He went in the forest and dug them up
them
in.
Yes, and if you put one in your soil, it's going to crawl to Walt's. Yeah. Caller, we want to thank you for calling. Have you another question or thought?
Just one quick question. I'm a very new gardener here in Fairbanks. Should a person just go out at a certain point, maybe within the next week or so, and just literally pull out all the flowers and stuff? Would that be to get the bed, to strip the bed down if they're annuals for the winter?
Let them freeze first.
Yeah. Let them freeze first. Okay, thank you very much.
One more thing with the chickweed. I would stay away from horse manure, or if you're using horse manure, it has to be composted because the horse sends all the seeds through. And that's the source of so much of the chickweed. So you may have a completely clean garden, and then you put horse manure on it, which is a great free local fertilizer, and you start all over. So it needs to be separated and composted, get very hot, ferment out, and then you can use it.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Keep listening. This is Conversations. We have another caller on the line. If you'd like to get in on this conversation, we've got another 10 minutes or so. The number to call is 474-5044. We haven't covered it all. If we're missing things and you're sitting there wondering why we haven't talked about, I don't know, what to do with the zucchini that's in your garden, give us a call. We'll try and help or turn the question over to someone else who's listening. You're on the line.
Hi, I have two questions. One, I'd like to follow up with the chickweed. Can you put the chickweed that you've pulled out of the garden onto your compost pile and after it's composted, put it back in to the garden?
Does it get hot enough?
If you get it hot enough, yeah. It should be steaming and absolutely uncomfortably hot to the touch if you run a shovel down into it. If it doesn't get that hot, then the seed doesn't get destroyed.
If in doubt, cart the chickweed away. That's kind of the philosophy I've taken anyway. I compost everything else, and I've got plenty of stuff composting, so I don't mess with the chickweed. I carry the 33 gallons worth of chickweed out.
Okay, the second question I have has to do with a type of mushroom fungus or something that's growing in my lawn. And It seems that it's all the places where the moose have left their nice little droppings last winter has come up with a very heavy, heavy growth of mushrooms or fungus that are all very close together, clumped. If I reach down, I can pull them up. But if I don't pull them up, they'll clog the lawnmower and almost cut it out because they're so thick. What does this do to the lawn, and how can I get rid of it?
What do we have here? Anyone know?
It could be any one of a number of things, some of which are highly toxic and some of which are edible. But I would just pull them up. They'll eventually go away. If it's a consistent problem, liming often, with rock lime will help. But I would just pull them up.
Do you sprinkle the rock lime? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, you can take it with a hand and with your hand and cast it around.
Okay.
It neutralizes the soil. Most of the lawns around here tend within a year or two to get moss in them anyway, which is a sign that they're getting acidic. And so just regular lime that you buy in the stores, don't go near the quick limes and things, will take care of both the moss and much of the mushroom.
Here's a question I have about the lawns. I've thatched mine every couple of years, just rented a thatcher and run it over. Is that a healthy thing to do up here, given the peculiars that can start to grow?
Again, we disagree. Uh-huh. There's two schools on that. I don't thatch mine because I think it puts the humus back into the soil and you gradually build up a protective cover. And so I do take the clippings off, but I don't thatch it. I think you need that around here.
Good. I didn't like that job anyway. I'm learning to like tilling. Patty Castelli.
And one point about lawns. This is way past the point, but when I was interviewing someone who was an expert in growing grass seed for Arctic conditions, they cautioned us very strenuously not to fertilize after early July. Mm-hmm. And so if some of you out there are Midwesterners and used to fertilizing throughout the summer into September, We'd advise you not to do that next year, that you fertilize in the spring as soon as you can, and maybe later in June if you're just trying to get a lawn going. But after that, no. Certainly not now in the fall.
And especially with high nitrogen fertilizers, mm-hmm. which are really great early in the season, but not late in the season.
Once again, what happens is if we get a warm September, the lawn will start to grow again, like you mentioned, of trees and plants, right? And then mm-hmm. it gets mm-hmm. all its
and
fresh,
it freezes,
green, delicate growth out, freezes, and dies.
Which is great for the snow mold.
Good thinking if you're trying to raise snow molds.
Yes.
We have a couple of other callers on the line. Caller, have you another question before we run away?
Just one other question. You mentioned fruit trees, the apple trees, and I heard someone else say cherry trees. Where can one get a variety of cherry or apple tree that will produce in Alaska, in Fairbanks?
My suggestion would be to call. There are a number of nurseries both in the local area and in the Anchorage-Palmer area. My suggestion would be to call the experimental farm and Pat Holloway, who's in charge of the apple experiments that the university is doing. So I would call Pat Holloway and the university.
And in fact, if you take a walk up in the Botanic Garden now, they've got a number of varieties they've moved down so you can get an idea of what these bushes look like.
Right, right.
Wonderful. Thank you, caller. Keep listening. This is Conversations. We've got about 5 minutes to go, so we'll have to scurry on our questions. Hours go so quickly. Caller, you're on the line.
Hello. I have a problem with mold in my hanging baskets, and I was wondering what I can do to prevent it from happening next year.
That's where the equisetum or the chamomile tea would come in. If you'll just water instead of with regular water, if you'll make a real strong chamomile tea, you can get the chamomile in most of the stores locally, and use that to water your plants. You'll get rid of most of the mold.
You can also use commercial fungicides if you want to. It just depends on how you want to deal with that. I mean, there are the Captans and the Benamils. There are a whole series of ones you can buy. But then again, you got to deal with the chemicals. Mm. Not advocating it, just noting they're available.
Do I have to change the dirt?
I don't think so, particularly if you're using something that does kill the fungus, whether it's a commercial fungicide or, say, one of the herbal treatments.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Keep listening. This is Conversations on KUAC-FM. We have another caller on the line. If you'd like to jump in here, a couple minutes left. The number to call is 474-5044. Walt Benish, Patty Kostelic, John Leipzig, answering your questions about gardens. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a horrible problem with the horsehair grass. I'm wondering what I can do to get rid of it.
Horrible horsehair.
You mean the stuff that comes up in little bushes, the equisetum?
I don't know what the technical term for it is.
Horsetail.
It's very, very, very feathery and very, very green.
It has it doesn't have a root system. It has a companion, a sort of system like that. It goes very deep. It can go down as much as 10 feet. The only thing you can do for it is just when you see them, pull them up, and they will eventually exhaust themselves. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's not a thing of going down very, very deep to get a root because it's going so far down, just keep after it.
It may go down deep or it may go sideways. It's 20 feet. They're just, it just takes time. And the more you're working the soil, the more you're planting flowers and other things, the more they tend to exhaust and die.
Great. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for your call. This is Conversations. We'll take one last call. Wonder where the caller went. Oh, bye. Good. There you are. Hi, are you on the air?
Yes.
Good. Come ahead.
We have three birch trees that have their leaves have completely turned brown throughout the summer. We had an extension agent out here, and he did take a branch of the tree. We have not heard from him. Do you have any idea what may have caused it? If not, there doesn't seem to be any bugs or worms in the leaves. They aren't rolled. They're just dried up.
And the man absconded with your tree?
Maybe he's on vacation.
Well,
no.
Oh, any thoughts about that?
Is there something that has been done near the trees that might have disturbed the root system or introduced some sort of poison into the soil?
Like, well, did you use weed and feed?
No, we haven't used any weed and feed around these trees. And I don't think we've used any other weed killer of any kind.
You know, because sometimes those roots will go out so far that if you used weed and feed, 50 feet away, I got into the root hairs. And
Well, did you use weed and feed on the lawn? She said no.
Okay.
They didn't use weed and feed on the lawn, and it's away from the lawn that we would have used it on anyway.
No, it sounds like the trees are, that there might be two things. One, that the trees are dying or dead, or that you just had a very, very heavy infestation of gypsy moths or something, a parasite that you didn't notice, and that's killed the leaves. And if that's the case, the tree will be all right next year. And I would wait and see, and you'll know in the spring if it leafs out that it's all right, and if it doesn't leaf out that it's then dead.
But she could probably go back to Cooperative Extension or down to the experimental farm.
Yeah, I would call them and see what happened to your study.
Working on it, I think.
And while you go down, pick up your soil bags and test your soil this fall. It's the best thing you can do, like the guy with the lilacs. Mm. The problem might be his pH. Mm-hmm. So he may need to adjust his pH. All the fertilizer in the world might not do any good if it can't absorb it.
Test your soil. Yep. Put your gardens to bed. We want to thank all of you for your calls. Thank you, ma'am. Thanks for calling. We want to thank all of you for your calls. It's been an interesting and fairly wide-ranging hour. We'll do this again next year on Conversations. Open the gardens and check in at midsummer and then shut them down again. I'm Susan McGinnis. Next week on Conversations, singer Margaret Whiting, known as the Queen of Cabaret, who was in town a couple of weeks ago, will be in town on tape in a conversation on this radio station, KUAC-FM. Join me again next week. Thanks to Glenn Estabrook and Lisa Penrose for helping, to Walt Benish, to Patty Kostelic and John Leipzig for joining me in studio today. Best to your Sunday. We'll talk to you again next week.